And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. How's everybody?
Great.
Doing great.
Oh, let's have some intros. Glenn Weldon, what do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comics for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do for NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org.
And I forget who you are.
Well, I am Stephen Thompson with NPR Music, lest you forget.
And what do you do?
I'm with NPR Music, but I'm an editor. I write.
I understand. Just being with NPR Music is enough.
No. Just my affiliation.
I understand.
I bask in the reflected glory of NPR Music.
I understand. Well, our big announcement this week, I think it's safe to say, is that we finally got an administrative problem solved, such that we finally have a Facebook address. You can find us at Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH.
Whoa!
Ooh. It's almost logical.
It's almost intuitive.
Nigh logical.
And you should. There are thousands of you, believe it or not.
Thousands.
Sitting there chit-chatting about this and that.
A delightful community of aspiring librarians.
It's true.
Actual librarians.
Yeah. Librarians, right. Everybody from aspiring librarians to actual librarians.
Well, what I loved is that we've had our awesome librarians who we love in this discussion about like whether you can call yourself a librarian if you're at a certain point in your librarian training. I think we actually have a larger community of librarians than some librarians' organizations have. Anyway, we do love our Facebook page a little bit.
We really do.
And we also use it to generate ideas, which you will discover when I tell you that our first discussion topic this week came from our Facebook page.
Wow. Which you can find where?
Facebook.com/PCHH. And, you know, people will often say, I'd like to hear you talk about this or that. And if it's nothing that we know anything about, then we ignore you, of course. But
entirely based on whether we know anything about it. Not
right.
Whether it's a good idea.
No. We look at it, we say, well, I've never heard of that. So obviously that would
books.
Not be. That must not be worth talking about. I've never even heard that. No, not really. But this week, we took a look at one. I think the original motivating idea was that sometimes you get in a sort of a rut and you're sort of alienated from your love of music or books or movies or whatever it is that you love. So we were asked, what are the things that you use as sort of comfort food to get yourself sort of reacquainted with your love of the things that you love?
Absolutely.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, yes. Taylor Salisbury Cole.
Hello,
suggests.
Taylor Salisbury.
Thank you, Taylor Salisbury Cole.
Thank
for
you, Taylor.
For preventing us from having to think of anything.
This topic is brought to you by the Taylor Salisbury Cole
Foundation.
Dancers.
Of the Boston Salisbury Cole.
Oh, good heavens.
Anyway, so Glenn, you want to kick it off?
Sure. Well, I'm going to ask a question first. Do we all agree around this table that for something to qualify as pop culture comfort food, at one point you must have gorged upon it? Is that fair to say?
The way one might with actual comfort.
Exactly.
Food.
I think that's fair.
And then you kind of take a break from it because it just ceases to kind of do anything for you. And then you find yourself over the course of your life returning to it again and again.
The same way that you do not eat macaroni and cheese every day unless you are.
Wait,
speak for yourself. Yes.
Unless
okay.
You are one of two people at this table, possibly three, counting our esteemed producer, Mike Katz.
Anyway, go ahead, Glenn.
I'll talk about movies first. This one is a thing that I return to again and again.
Johnny, what can you make out of this?
This? Well, I could make a cap, or a brooch, or a pterodactyl.
That, of course, is Johnny from the 1980 film Airplane, a film I keep going back to. And can we just take a moment here to give a shout-out to the character of Johnny in this 1980 film, a character that I think it's safe to say is not only merely gay, but really most sincerely gay. And yet, we are laughing with him, not at him.
Yes.
He is not the, as it were, butt of the joke. He is the guy making the jokes, and he's the thing that I just loved about this film.
That and the fact that it's hilarious.
Well, there's also
it
that.
It is.
It's just great, and it, you know, kind of teaches you something about humor. Just keep trying. Just keep plugging away.
That is the lesson from Zucker, Abram Zucker.
Absolutely.
That just keep pounding people with jokes.
Yep.
You have them have jokes in the foreground, have jokes in the background,
yep.
Have jokes sort of crawling along the bottom of the screen,
mm-hmm.
And
so
somewhere
true.
Something on the screen is going to make you laugh.
It's Wear them down.
Yeah, it's like a Eugene O'Neill play that way. You know,
it's a lot like Eugene O'Neill
exactly
play.
Like
misfortune after misfortune after woe after grimness after drug abuse after family mm-hmm. dysfunction until you just give in. You just cave in under the crushing. sadness of it all.
I think the lesson in this all is just surrender.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It does remind me of the Eugene O'Neill play, Jive Talking Grandma.
Long day's journey into Jive Talking Grandma.
One of my favorites.
The other film I keep going back to for slightly different reasons. I was a little bit older when this came out, and I could appreciate sort of filmmaking in a way that I couldn't necessarily when Airplane came out. It was Raising Arizona, the film that I keep going back to, and I have internalized that film, and I've internalized the jokes and the timing and the shots of that film. But in keeping with the Zucker Brothers thing, the television series Police Squad, mm-hmm. not the Naked Gun films, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, I didn't kind of respond to the Naked Gun
really?
Films.
I love the Naked Gun
films. I thought they were missing the mark. I thought there was something crystalline about the Police Squad television show that I just...
Crystalline?
Crystalline. It worked.
What?
It was...
Anodyne, would you say?
It was multi-faceted.
Gorgeous.
You could expose it to different angles of light.
I don't know what the hell I was saying, but that's neither here nor there. And, you know, gotta say it, Doctor Who. Mm. I like the new series a lot. I don't think I would like it as much if it didn't have so many elements of this thing that I watched on Saturday nights when I was 5 years old, you know, staying up really late so I could hear the sound of the TARDIS materializing and dematerializing. If this new series didn't have that stuff in it, I don't think it would connect mm-hmm. with me in such a primal way.
You don't think on its own it would necessarily
I doubt
earn
it.
The kind of loyalty from
I doubt
you
it. I think it. It's some of its cachet is how it connects with you in such a basic way.
Excellent.
And when they say don't put the Doctor Who mug in the dishwasher, don't put the Doctor Who mug in the dishwasher.
Good to know.
Yeah.
I'm already down to 2 out of 3.
Oh, dear. Oh. Well, presumably it's still a mug.
It's still a mug. Now it's just a mug.
All right. Well, Glenn Weldon has set the table with TV and movies. Trey Graham, what do you have for us?
If you've ever felt like you never, ever, never need to see a high school romantic comedy again, I recommend Easy A, which we have talked about on Twitter. And which we may have discussed on the podcast, too. I forget. It's smart. The writer is a playwright, as it happens. And it's funny and warm, and it's got a classy cast that is not trying at all too hard. It is just about pitch perfect in every regard. It's probably too recent to be comfort food in the way that macaroni and cheese is a comfort food that you remember from your childhood, but
slash adulthood,
yeah.
Right?
But it is certainly comfort food that I encountered recently and would heartily recommend to somebody who's gotten sick to the full to the gullet on to steal a Stephen Thompson word on subpar romantic comedies.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the comfort food of the future.
Yes.
I think that's it. Yeah,
definitely. Mm-hmm.
I think that absolutely. Is a fair choice. I mean, I haven't seen the movie. I'm kind of dying to see it because I've heard nothing but great things.
Oh, you're gonna love it.
But this kind of movie, these movies that you know the moment you see it, you can just watch it again and again and again, and it's not going to lose any of its...
Absolutely. An excellent choice.
Thank you.
Stephen Thompson.
All right, I decided to dig back into the vaults and pick a movie, since we seem to be starting with movies, that I have seen at least parts of about 7,000 times, which is a film from 1944 called Laura.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Sort of film noir-ish with just absolutely crackling, wonderful, wonderful dialogue. The actor that I come back to again and again is Clifton Webb as Waldo Leidecker, who is one of the suspects in this in this murder. I've fallen asleep with this movie on many, many times, and I think that's actually a sign of great sort of cinematic comfort food. If for one thing, just a minor point, the DVD menu does not play a theme that recycles itself every 15 seconds. You'd better watch out, McPherson, or you'll wind up in a psychiatric ward. I doubt they've ever had a patient who fell in love with a corpse.
Dun, dun. Yeah.
In my case, self-absorption is completely justified. I've never discovered any other subject quite so worthy of my attention.
It now, speaks to you, does it?
Is that you're doing Clifton Webb there? Because it sounds an awful lot like George Saunders.
I'm not saying I can do a...
He's not Rich Little over here.
Yeah, okay.
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok. It's lavish, but I call it home.
Can you read that in your Trump voice, please?
That's right.
No.
No.
It's lavish, but I call it home would work.
That's right. It's lavish!
All right.
Anyway, it is a delightful film. It is a wonderfully acted film. As you can tell from that, it's very, very crisply written in a way that the more you watch it, the more the cadences become very comforting. It is, like I said, a movie I come back to again and again. There are certainly a million comedies that I've seen 100 million billion times. This is Spinal Tap. Mm-hmm. You know, is definitely one that I probably, that somewhere in the back of my head, it is completely memorized. Mm-hmm. The one that I wanted to pick was Laura.
Look at you going back to the golden age of Hollywood.
Oh, it's such a surprise.
Back to the golden age indeed.
It is such a good movie.
It's a gorgeous looking film too.
It's a beautiful, beautiful film.
Very good. Very good. I will say that I actually had the experience this weekend of running into one that I very much feel this way about, which is the movie My Bodyguard, which has a kid named Chris Makepeace, who did not do a whole lot more acting after this, and Adam Baldwin, who is the non-Baldwin Baldwin. He's the Baldwin who's not a Baldwin. And Adam Baldwin plays...
But he would be like the second best Baldwin.
He would be the first best Baldwin. So anyway, Makepeace plays this kid named Clifford, who comes to school and is menaced by a bully played by Matt Dillon. And it's so awesome. And the bully, you know, wants to push him around and take his lunch money. The sort of scam to take his money is, you have to pay me because, wink, wink, I'm protecting you from this kind of lumbering, big, silent kid who doesn't talk, but everybody talks about him, that he has done all these horrible, violent things, and he's so scary, and so, we're going to protect you from him, but of course, really, you're protecting yourself from the bullies themselves. And eventually, as you can imagine, he eventually meets this kid and figures out what's going on with him, and you know, the title comes from something that's not actually all that central to the movie, but it provides the impetus for them to meet, which is, he turns it around on Matt Dillon and decides, I'm going to get the bully to be my body. I'm going to pay Linderman, this big kid, to be my bodyguard. It's hard to explain all the things that I love about this movie. It is so wonderful and lovely. It has Ruth Gordon plays his grandma, his dotty
old grandma.
Ruth Gordon
makes everything better.
And Martin Mull is his father working at this hotel. And it's
Martin Mull makes some things better.
It's hard to quantify exactly what I love about it. It's like Lucas in that way. It's like the movie Lucas that Corey Haim is in, and sadly Charlie Sheen was in.
It's warm without being schmaltzy.
It is. And it's
sincerely warm.
It is in places kind of schmaltzy, but oh gosh, it's so fun. It has tiny little Joan Cusack. Tiny.
Tiny little Joan
Tiny little Joan Cusack. It's one of these movies that always makes me feel happy to see it again. And when I stumble across it in any setting, I always think, oh, man, I'm going to watch that movie again. I mean, I think it's like what Trey said about Easy A. There's something about movies about teenagers that sort of becomes very, I don't know, it's very eternal. In a way, I absolutely love it.
Now, I'm having a little trouble keeping up. Where does Kevin Costner fit in this film?
That's the other Bodyguard
Sorry.
Movie.
Right.
My Bodyguard as opposed to The Bodyguard.
And this is what, 83?
It's early 80s, yeah. I highly recommend it. It is on Netflix Instant.
I used to watch this movie on cable all the time. I have not seen it in probably 25 years, but I was obsessed with it. I loved this movie when I was a kid. I'm totally going to dig it out.
And Matt Dillon as the bully just has this incredibly, as you would say, punchable face. And he's so bad. He's so bad. Get it? So bad. It's a great movie. And while we're on the topic of Joan Cusack, the other one that came to mind for me was Working Girl.
Oh, sure.
With Melanie Griffith and Joan Cusack and Harrison Ford at his most awesome Harrison Ford-y kind of sexy romantic comedy guy thing. And Working Girl is one of those movies that is so dated in the sense that it's got the sort of the women in the suits and the feathered hair and the shoulder pads.
And the
entire idea that we all sort of worship this world of mergers and acquisitions, which wouldn't really be as romantic now, I don't think, as it was then. It's very sort of oriented around the idea of moving up through business and industry as being the ultimate in romantic in the general sense, fantasies of how your life is going to go. But nevertheless, I find it so funny and sweet in this weird, bizarre way. And Sigourney Weaver is so funny playing this kind of, you know, terrible, shrewish.
What could have been a very caricaturish.
A very caricaturish, but in a way you sort of feel for her at certain moments, even though she does these awful things. There is something a little bit sympathetic about her. And the close of this movie, and I've talked about this before, there are a couple of scenes that happen when everything has kind of, you know, without giving too much away, when everything has kind of settled out, there's kind of a coda. And the coda is so sweet and kind that it sort of gives everybody an ending that feels a little bit richer than if it ended the first time it could have ended. Mm. And I love it for that reason. It's got all kinds of, I mean, it's got little tiny Alec Baldwin in it as her sort of schmuck boyfriend. People walk in and out of this movie, and Harrison Ford has this scene where, my favorite scene in the movie, he's changing his shirt in his office. And it's not salacious. He's got a t-shirt on the whole time. But he keeps spare shirts in his drawer because he's worked so late. He's on the phone with her the whole time. And the people in his office, he gradually becomes aware, are watching him because his office is kind of glassed in. And there's this wonderful moment where, without breaking the conversation, he sort of turns to all the people in the office and sort of spreads his arms wide, like, whatever. And they all applaud. And the whole time he's just talking. It's really, really warm and funny, and I love it.
What you said about the coda that sort of gives the characters a last moment of grace, mm-hmm. I think is kind of important. You know, when you can feel that a director and a screenwriter or screenwriters have an affection for the characters or have some charity toward the characters, that they don't want to make anybody necessarily the be-all, end-all villain in what is essentially, after all, a comedy. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was a movie theater usher when this film came out, and I was if this movie was out on nights that I was ushing, I would go into the theater for the Joan Cusack moments, and then go back someplace else.
Yeah, yeah.
I love Joan Cusack in this film.
Oh, she's so funny in it. It's awesome. And very much comfort food to me. So, Glenn Weldon, do you have anything else?
Music. I grew up in the mean streets of suburban Philadelphia, and there was a classic rock stations were thick on the ground. Top 40 stations were thick on the ground. Neither of those were my jam, literally or figuratively. Mm-hmm. And this was before the rise of WXPN, which is a great radio station in Philadelphia now, but before it didn't really get out to the suburbs.
At that time, it would have been WMMR.
WMMR, YSP.
YSP. I'm sure you were way too cool for WSTW.
Trey and I are going to go grab a snack.
Yeah, we're just filing our nails now.
No. So I tried, Lord knows I tried, to manufacture enthusiasm. My first concert was Van Halen, but at some point I was looking around for something else, and if I was a more emo teenager, I might have found the Smiths and locked onto them. If I was an angrier teenager, I might have found the Violent Femmes. If I was a teenager who had even a shot at having sex with anyone, I would have found Roxy Music, maybe. But as it was, I was
Joan Jett.
Horribly, insufferably pretentious kid, so I locked on to this band who wore its art school sensibility on its sleeve, who made songs with abstract, kind of impenetrable lyrics. No story songs for this band. Story songs were for sucks. Mm-hmm. And the groove was infectious. This is the band that I discovered. All right, that's Talking Heads. The name of this band is Talking Heads. From the album Speaking in Tongues, that's the song Pull Up the Roots. This is the band that shaped me for good and for ill. This is the band that I convince myself, and I think everybody has this band, where they convince themselves that they can do no wrong, even when they produce a really sucky album, Naked. This led me to a really insufferable part of my childhood, where I was only listening to Laurie Anderson, Peter Gabriel, before he sold out.
Sure.
Before he
plays
sold
live
out.
Peter Gabriel.
Between Genesis and...
Yes. Actually, yeah. And Talking Heads, the holy trinity of pretentio rock.
Yeah.
That's what I was listening to. And I just keep coming back to this band again and again. I've internalized everything about this band, every lyric, every key change, but I keep coming back.
How did you feel about XTC?
I love them too.
Thinking,
but they were.
I was thinking you might go the XTC. Right?
They were in Dukes of Stratosphere, of course. But this is the one that I love.
Very, very good. Trey Graham, what do you have?
Books. We talked last week about genres that we can't resist. So, in the realm of comfort food for me, Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, and Emma, of course, as you would imagine. repressed costume dramas. Mm-hmm. Many, many, many things.
It's a through line.
Under the bodice. But if we are talking about cozy and not particularly edifying or illuminating pleasures...
And we are.
...that we like to revisit once in a while, as with a once dazzling old friend who seems less and less worldly as the years go by. Not that I'm the kind of person who thinks of his friends like that. There is an author named Catherine Kurtz who wrote a series of novels set in a variant of the medieval British Isles, England, Scotland, Wales, where there's a very powerful church and a race of people with inherent magical powers who are overtly, explicitly, and officially anathema. There are something like 15 of these books, and I like to go back and read the early ones sometimes, because even though there's a pretty clear line where Catherine Kurtz kind of reached the limits of invention and started relying on formula, the characters still feel like friends that I made when I was a teenager, friends who might have actually understood me then. And I hate to say this because it sounds woeful and mopey and emo, but they might have understood me when I was a teenager, and I felt like they would have understood me when I was a teenager because of their secrets and their status as de facto alienated.
Nice. Mm.
De facto and de jure alienated.
The
Derrynee Chronicles, the Chronicles of the Derrynee, the Chronicles of St. Camber, and I forget what, the Chronicles of King Kelsen.
I read those books. Not enough magic.
But were there enough maps?
There were maps.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yes. Excellent. Thank you, Trey Graham.
You are welcome.
Stephen Thompson.
I got no books.
Yeah, well.
Though when I was a kid, and I really tried to go with stuff that was not just stuff that I loved when I was a kid.
Sure.
If it were stuff when I was a kid, it would be everything that Dave Barry wrote. As a pockmarked dork, mm-hmm. Sat around snickering at old Dave Barry books.
Sure.
I have a feeling Linda may go in this direction too, but sitcoms on DVD. For me, though, it's often been more recent. It hasn't mm-hmm. necessarily been ones as a kid. Arrested Development mm-hmm. is one where, you know, you get to the point, and Simpsons certainly, where you get to the point where you can just, it just becomes a part of your vocabulary to the mm-hmm. point where you actually have to take like a decade off. Yeah. But they certainly qualify as comfort food, as my kids have now been discovering The Simpsons like crazy.
And The Muppet Show,
thanks sure. to Linda. Old sitcoms, comfortable sitcoms. I find the first umpteen seasons of The Office mm-hmm. are really, really nice on DVD. It's mm-hmm. a very low-key show. Mm-hmm. I tend to think in terms of things to watch or listen to while in bed.
Yes.
As a big part of this assignment.
Absolutely. Nothing wrong with that.
So sitcoms on DVD. Music-wise, I've already talked 9 billion times about how much I love Clem Snide, mm-hmm. but Clem Snide, your favorite music is the ultimate, mm-hmm. ultimate comfort food.
Agreed.
Real quick, it qualifies as comfort food. Do you put your critical music, NPR music thing aside when you're listening to it, or do you appreciate
it? It's already my favorite. Mm-hmm. If it makes me comfortable, it's already my favorite. I really try not to differentiate between the best and my favorite. Mm-hmm. I tend to try to write about music from the standpoint of whether it's my favorite. And so when I do the best albums of the year, it's not necessarily like this, you know, expanded the boundaries of sound. It's always, this is what I love.
Yeah, best is, when you're a critic, best is not an empirical thing.
So. Best is not humble either. Yeah.
If you want to know what the best is, you can look at Metacritic and get mm-hmm. sort of a composite right. review of what the critical consensus says is the best, whereas I feel like that stuff is personal. So certainly, if you haven't already on my recommendation, Clem Snide, your favorite music, one of my favorite albums of all time, great music to listen to in bed. Laura Gibson, If You Come to Greet Me, is her first album.
Up with the sunrise, you'll be staring out through the window all the day. I'll be another waking shadow cast on the covers of your bed. Give me another shine against the solemn gray. Tell me seasons almost over. I can wait.
My son in particular went to bed with that playing like every night for months and months, if not years.
Well, Gracie was going to bed to Thriller. So true.
It's totally true. Anything Laura Gibson does, but that first record is really, really beautiful. If you want very, very quiet, low-key, head-clearing, comfort foodie music, a band called Stars of the Lid which makes kind of very cinematic. The band is named for like what you see on the insides of your eyelids.
Oh, I see.
But it's so good. Stars of the Lid and the Refinement of the Decline is a record I've listened to 100 times while editing. As far as ultimate comfort food, the Kinks' Waterloo Sunset.
Okay. There you go.
All righty. Can I make a bonus musical recommendation?
No.
I'll keep it very short.
Yes, you may.
Very, very short. This will not come as a surprise to anyone who knows anything about German art song, but for those of you...
For those that opening. I love that opening.
What? Sorry.
Say nothing else.
I can't help it.
You're golden.
Stop
right there.
But if you would like just some beautiful noise to explore, listen to the Jesse Norman recording of Strauss's 4 last songs, specifically the 3rd of those songs. It's called Beim Schlafengehen.
Google
that. Beim Schlafengehen. Shut up, all of you. It is one of the great recordings of the 20th century, and it is just as an outpouring of tone and sound and lushness. I cannot recommend anything more highly.
But like a palate cleanser, though.
I actually, you would think that 4 songs about death would be depressing for some people.
But if you don't know what she's singing.
But we're talking about this as comfort food. And in fact, I have used this as a sort of cathartic, palate cleansing, soul cleansing thing when I'm feeling low. It is so beautiful that it transcends what it's about. And in fact, once you have a conversation about what the text of the poems is actually about, it's about death as the fitting end for a full and well-lived life, right? So in both ways, it's sort of comforting to me. It is
it doesn't make
simply...
You, it doesn't make you wallow in the fact that you are not living a well-lived life?
I would argue that by listening to this, you are.
Schlaffenrific.
Very good, very good. I always like to take a moment in the show and wrap up our first topic with another round of we say nice things about people we know personally. So I'm just going to mention that in, I believe, 2005, my friends I have spoken about many, many times before, Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano, who ran Television Without Pity editorially when I worked there, recorded a series of conversations based on things that Sarah wrote on her website. And it's an album called The Girls Bike Club.
Oh,
and it's this series of dialogues that Sarah wrote, semi-based on conversations she and Tara had actually had. But Tara always says most of it is just Sarah writing. And it's basically, it's these dialogues where they discuss this fictional concept of the Girls Bike Club. Originally, it was about taking male celebrities who had gotten, like, DUIs or otherwise could not be trusted on their own, and you would just assign them girls' bikes, and that would be the only way they'd be allowed to get around. They would all be riding around on girls' bikes. It starts off with this thing about Phil Collins on a girl's bike. Phil Collins should go get a paper route, they say. Mm-hmm. Eventually, there's a clubhouse and a hideout. And there's all this back and forth about like which one pops wheelies and picks on the little kids and puts cards in the spokes of the bike. And there's this very sort of massive world of, and it's just joke making. There is a rhythm to the comedy of these pieces and the voice that always makes me want to go try to write something funny. It's weird and it's hilarious and it's incredibly inventive, and it's celebrity culture, but in this really pointed, smart, but at the same time kind of lowbrow, trashy, but yet super, super elevated kind of way. Mm-hmm. It's everything I love about the kind of comedy place that I came from and worked in. And I discovered that you can still buy it on iTunes. If you search on iTunes for Girls Bike Club, you can still buy the Girls Bike Club recordings. Highly recommended. I listen to them all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm noticing is that this, in terms of pop culture comfort food is, you think of it as something you just kind of wallow in and protect yourself against the world. Mm-hmm. But over and over again, we're talking about things that inspire us do things, to
take it. Absolutely. Yeah. Now that we have talked about all the things that we find to be our pop culture comfort food, I hope that all of you will come to the blog at Monkey See or to our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, and tell us about your pop culture comfort foods. So That brings us to our next segment. We're going to do a quick round of one of our favorite things, the regrettable television pop quiz.
I believe, Linda, that though we've retired other songs.
That's true.
Yeah. But there is still a theme song for the regrettable television
there
pop
is.
Quiz.
It is the regrettable television pop quiz. So we're going to take a quick go and see what we come up with. Mike Katzoff, you want to cue up our first clip?
My restaurant concept name would be Soups. And my inspiration probably comes from Soups.
I know what this is.
I do too.
I actually know.
So
who of us?
Stephen Priest.
Is it Chopped?
It's not Chopped. No.
That's a salad place.
Yeah, thanks.
It's also a show.
It is too. A show.
So this is Stephen's regrettable television pop quiz, and it was going to be my "What's Making Me Happy." This is America's Next Great Restaurant, and it is the dumbest. It is so dumb. It's so dumb. It's all these people who want to create a restaurant, and the prize is going to be they're going to open three of them
in a few weeks.
Yeah, it's like you're supposed to be coming up with like the next Chipotle.
Yes, we'll get to that.
So there's like a guy who wants to do casual Indian, and there's a guy who wants to do like all this other stuff. What were you
going
to say?
I was going to say that somewhere when this show aired, Donald Trump is sitting there saying, "Enough with the self-promotion already," because every segment is like, "We're trying to find the next Chipotle, and boy, you know what's a really well-run restaurant that these hammerheads can't run properly? Chipotle. I got a saying over at Chipotle. Chipotle is awesome," or whatever. I can't remember what the food with soul or whatever, you know.
And I have been heard to talk about this on Twitter because, you see, there was a guy who had a great idea, and his great idea has now been dismissed. And that means...
Spoiler.
That means... It's not a spoiler. It was already on. Big dope. And that means that there will never be my dream, the grilled cheese restaurant chain.
Oh.
I think the grilled cheese restaurant is by far the best idea that these people have had.
Agree.
I do not understand why I do not already have several grilled cheese restaurants. And yes, every time I see these people write me and think, "I have a grilled cheese restaurant where I live," I say, "Well, that's fine."
Yes.
I don't have a grilled cheese restaurant where I live, and therefore I would like there to be one, and now there's not going to be one because they threw him out.
Well, and the rationale for why they were like, "I don't know about this grilled cheese idea," is like, well, anybody can make a grilled cheese sandwich. You know what? When I work up at NPR's New York Bureau, nearby, there is a sandwich stand where they make delicious peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on big, thick bread with giant splotches of peanut butter and jelly. You know what I know how to make? Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Do you know what I like to eat? Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. There should be grilled cheese. Just because I can make it doesn't mean I'm going to when I'm out.
Come on, grilled cheese franchise.
Grilled cheese.
Anyway.
Semi on board with this show, but the endless flogging of Chipotle makes me hungry for Chipotle.
I support you. All right, Mike Katzoff, second clip.
Last night's Dancing with the Stars from Kirstie Alley's dancing partner Max, who stumbled under the weight of the pressure at Kirstie Alley. Ow, 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 damn, that hurts. Hashtag pain.
You can really feel the pain through the all caps.
Oh, I can't get enough Kirstie Alley fat jokes.
Yeah.
What is that? This is Trey's, obviously, because the rest of us are.
Kirstie Alley fat jokes. Anybody guesses?
What is
that?
Whatever it is, I want to put it into a rocket and fire it into the sun.
What is it?
This is The Morning After, which is a clip show.
Oh.
It's about 3 months old, brought to you by Hulu Hulu's push into the original programming arena.
Oh. Is it supposed to be like The Soup?
It is supposed to be like The Soup. They also...
If you love The Soup, but wish it were less good.
You wish it were more grating and less inspired, more
insistent.
More poorly written.
Yeah.
They also, believe it or not, they talk about Keith Olbermann era Sports Center as one of the inspirations for this show. It is hosted by a former bit player from Heroes, who in terms of vague familiarity and face punchability is to Kevin Dillon as Kevin Dillon is to Matt Dillon.
Well executed.
Thank you very much. And by a very pretty woman who appeared in an NBC web series called In Gale We Trust, which was apparently about an insurance agent who solves all of her neighbor's problems, a saintly insurance agent. The sole sponsor of this web series was, yes, American Family Insurance.
There you go.
Anyway, this clip show, The Morning After, is hands down, as you have already sort of indicated, the most hectic thing I have ever tried to keep up with for 5 minutes. It's only 5 minutes long. If you think it sounds a little bit like the people might be on crystal meth, you should get a look at the visuals. They're really, really busy, but at the same time, they're also trying to be all slick to make this thing look like Extra or Entertainment Tonight. And I think that is where it loses me completely, as mm-hmm. you know, because I might be willing to stay with it while it sort of mm-hmm. works out its writing. Mm-hmm. If you put it up against something like The Soup, which, let's face it, is where I go when to pull an all-nighter when right. I know that we're going to do this segment. you start to understand that Hulu kind of wants it both ways here. The Morning After is in the business of mild cheap shots, but it is also in the business of selling television shows. It just kind of right. Ends up kind of feeling shrill but toothless at the same time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Don't like it. No. All right, next up.
Good luck with him, because you should have told me about her. Screw you.
Whatever.
This isn't funny.
Whatever
this isn't funny.
Okay, we're far enough. Just sit.
I swear to God, if you're pulling some right now, it's not funny.
Holy.
Okay.
Is this Flash Mobs? I heard
it's
Howie. I heard
mobbed.
Howie Mandel's voice.
It's Mob.
I also love the music that makes it sound like the ship has just hit an iceberg.
Right.
The thing about that is, what they did on Mobbed is they set this thing up where they were going to do a proposal accompanied by a flash mob dancing and singing, which whatever.
Like a marriage proposal?
A marriage proposal. But Howie Mandel told them that he wanted to like spice it up. So they started it by having a woman come up and throw a drink in the guy's face. She was the one you heard at the beginning of the clip who said, good luck with him, and then threw it again. You should have told me about her. Basically, they faked it up to look like he was being confronted by someone with whom he was cheating on his girlfriend.
Because you want that to be the memory of your
So when she is saying, this isn't funny, 30 seconds later, they all start singing and dancing, and then she's like, oh, and then they go through the proposal, and he proposes, and she says yes, and then they actually get married in front of the flash mob in a situation where they ship in all the friends and the family. They put her in a wedding dress that goes on over her clothes because, of course, well, it all is happening right now. Just come right up here. We're going to get you married. And they put a wedding dress on over her clothes, which no one even buttons up in the back. So she's just wearing this smocky looking thing, and then there's some dude she doesn't know, and a gigantic flash mob full of strangers, and her wedding has been planned by the network.
Yeah.
And
wow,
then
way to make Britney Spears' Vegas nuptials look classy.
In Mob, they really got married, supposedly, although I don't know how that works because you have to get a license, and so no one really understands how that's possible, but supposedly they really got married at the end of the show. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say that.
Good.
All righty, Mike Katza.
Emotionally, you are very immature.
Well, who knew?
I think I'm very mature.
That's why you get along so well with your kids.
Not always. Yeah?
Elsa said I was emotionally immature, which is like nowhere near my personality and who I am. You know, I kind of felt like maybe she was attacking me. Maybe because I was like younger and cuter than everyone else.
No, clearly.
Is that the creepy old lady on Real Housewives of Miami?
I was going to say, it sounds Real Housewives-y.
It is Real Housewives of Miami. Ding, 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 ding. Yes, I am watching this show because my partner is from Miami, and it's over now, thankfully.
This... Your relationship?
No, that's right. One more episode, and we would have talked. Okay. So this is, you know, the reason he's watching it is because, oh, look, there's Lincoln Road. Hey, that's the place where I grew up. Oh, look, there's Ocean Drive. You know, it's Miami porn, basically. Mm-hmm. And I have made the point repeatedly to him that we could have just rented a video from the Miami Chamber of Commerce and not have to go through any of this crap. I glean from your discussion of other Real Housewives shows and from The Soup that the thing about this series is the manufactured drama, the people wanting to apologize, waiting for their apology.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. At this iteration of the show, which is like, I think maybe the 17th, I don't know, these women are so hyper-aware of the camera.
Yeah.
They are so self-conscious about how they're being perceived, and yet they're tremendously dull. Geologic time is the only way you can measure, you know, an episode of the show. It is so boring. Now, the first woman you heard is a mom who is of one of the housewives who is claiming she's a psychic, and she's this uber Cuban woman. The audio of her is a little hard to understand for several reasons. A, she has a very thick Cuban accent. B, she likes the occasional tipple. She'll have a dry sherry now and again, mm-hmm. or in the case of that particular scene, a giant goblet of Shiraz. Mm-hmm. And then her face has been stretched so much that I don't think we actually see the corners of her mouth. Mm-hmm. I think they are somewhere behind her ears. Mm-hmm. What she looks like, people say she looks like a cat. She actually looks more like the way they depict Canadians on South Park. She is Terrence and/or Philip, just with a floppy head at the top. It's so boring, the show. So boring. And you could just hear some of the shrill, horrible women going on. True. But I'm glad it's over.
Well, thank you, Glenn Weldon. And that's the regrettable television pop quiz for this week. And I think we all...
I think we did pretty well.
I think we did. Mm-hmm. We got some very, very regrettable things. Anyway, so the final segment, as always, is what is making us happy this week? Why don't we start with you, Steve?
I have mixed feelings about what's making me happy. I'm ultimately very satisfied with it. I highly recommend that people seek it out and enjoy it. But I'm a little torn. What is making me happy this week is that The Onion, my former employer, has made its first 8 years of its archives available online. So you can go to The Onion's website and see all these long-lost old papers. The first 7 years of The Onion were in black and white, and so it's very primitive. It's a very different publication. I have somewhat mixed feelings about it, as you can imagine, because it's a little bit like your mother posting a rich archive of photos of you on the potty.
Right.
And I
That's
have,
next week.
I have not yet...
Maggie, get on that.
Yeah, seriously.
I have not yet delved deep enough to see if they've included everything, such as my horrible, horrible writing in those days. Ultimately, it is a rich, very, very uneven, but in many cases, delightfully fun treasure trove of sort of lost old comedy that you would otherwise have to have in the form of yellowing stacks of newspapers. It is, of course, my dear hope that it is digitized and downloadable to the point where I can get rid of the, like, 3 filing cabinets of old issues of The Onion that I have in storage.
But, very good. Excellent.
There you go. Naked baby pictures. That's excellent. What's making me happy.
Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Speaking of naked baby pictures, I was hoping to be able to say baby animals in IMAX 3D, but I missed that screening, and Linda, who did go, said that the baby animals were somewhat disappointing in any case. So I am going with Lex Luthor on a big red bike. Anybody?
Mm-hmm.
No? I see that I will need to explain.
Yeah.
This is about the intersection of Capital Bike Share, which is part of a bike sharing culture, which is a thing that I like, and the annual Nancy Hanks Lecture on Arts and Public Policy, which is also a thing that I like. Kevin Spacey, Lex Luthor, was the guy who delivered it this year, the Nancy Hanks lecture. And a couple of hours earlier on his Twitter feed, he posted a photo of himself in front of the White House sitting on a Capital Bike Share bike and saying that his tour of D.C. had a small carbon footprint. I was talking to a friend who works for Americans for the Arts, which is the advocacy organization that puts on the Nancy Hanks lecture every year, and he told me that he'd heard that Spacey was threatening to take the Capital Bike Share bike to the Kennedy Center to give the speech. Now, I haven't been able to find out for sure whether this did in fact happen, but it was kind of a hilarious mental picture. You know, the couple of thousand people trickling into the Kennedy Center concert hall, and the guy they're coming to see is negotiating rush hour traffic on a bike in D.C. What could go wrong?
Sure.
I do know that, in fact, Spacey made it to the lecture, and in the context of talking about arts education and the importance thereof and his reasons for being involved in advocacy, he told what struck me as a fairly charming story about how Jack Lemmon gave him some praise and encouragement when he was young, and he said this: if you've been successful, it is your obligation to send the elevator back down. So I'm passing that on for discussion. Also, the idea of bike sharing, a thing that I like. Check it out. If you don't know what it is, look it up. And if it's not entirely too pay it forward for Glenn to stomach, I thought I would suggest that maybe our Facebook peoples might want to talk about the people who've made a difference in their lives and whether they've been able to send the elevator back down for anybody else.
Of course.
I'll allow it.
But only because Glenn is not on Facebook to delete
it.
It's
true.
Right. Yes.
Glenn's like, I'll never see it. So all right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Speaking of the Facebook page, I did post some of my favorite podcasts onto the Facebook page, under the discussion section of the Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH. And much as I love riff-based comedy podcasts, people just sort of being very loose, and people like Mark Maron's case, very personal, there is an intimacy that comes from these kind of podcasts.
Sure.
I do occasionally miss, what is the word, writing. And
a good, solid joke that has been worked over, that has been sharpened, I do feel every so often a yearning for that. Thankfully, there are some podcasts out there which produce scripted material, which are hilarious. And I've already given these a shout-out on the Facebook page, but I wanted to do it here. The Thrilling Adventure Hour is sort of an homage to old-time radio serials, but with a contemporary comic sensibility. It's written by Ben Acker and Ben Blacker. It is performed live at Largo at the Coronet in L.A. It is fantastic writing. It's very funny. Mike Detective, which is written by Neil Campbell and Scott Aukerman, is a homage to old-time noir detective serials, radio serials. So Thrilling Adventure Hour is at thrillingadventurehour.com. Mike Detective is at earwolf.com. And the last one isn't really writing because it is improv. It's called Super Ego. It's improvised, but here's the key. It is edited improv. So things that don't work don't make it into the podcast. Mm-hmm. And it is hugely funny, very brilliant, written by Jeff Crocker, Matt Gourley, Jeremy Carter, Matt McConville. GoSuperEgo.com. Fantastic.
Two quick things.
Yes.
I would just like to say that edited improv is cheating. And B, I would like to reserve the name Acker and Blacker for my Katya and Mariella Lebec cover band.
Okay.
Lovely. Well, what is making me happy this week? Okay, so grilled cheese.
Yeah. You got that covered. No.
Since we did already mention grilled cheese, which really was what I was going to talk about, was the grilled cheese guy and my soup. love of watching the grilled cheese guy. But since we already mentioned that, I normally would not do this because we have talked about Marc Maron a million times, and we have talked about that podcast a million times. But Marc Maron was on Weekend All Things Considered this weekend, and that interview is available on the blog Monkey See. That's a very interesting interview, but this Monday he put up an episode with Conan O'Brien, which I just loved. Like, the first 15 minutes of it, I feel like none of that stuff is about The Tonight Show, none of it is about this controversy. It's like them talking about how they grew up and how they feel about themselves, and it's so funny and it's so smart. And there's this part where Conan O'Brien starts explaining the thesis that he wrote in college about literature in the South. It's about Flannery O'Connor, and they start talking about Faulkner and all this stuff. And it's just, it's so much fun. And if you haven't taken our advice before about listening to WTF, which is Marc Maron's podcast, go find it. Just to listen to this Conan episode, if you have any interest in all that jazz. It was really, really interesting and a great episode, and I'm perfectly happy to sub that in as what's making me happy this week, since my grilled cheese got kind of taken away.
Yeah. Scarfed. Yeah.
My grilled cheese got intruded upon.
Constantly eating your grilled cheese. I ate your grilled cheese sandwich.
Who moved your cheese?
So that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Steven at...
You know, it sounded like you were singing it there.
I was not.
You can't sing it.
There was a small lilt.
Oh, for God's sake. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music. You are humming along to it right now. And in case we have not mentioned this, you can also find us on Facebook.
Oh, really?
At Facebook.com/PCHH.
Please like us.
Please like us. So that's it for this week. Thanks to all of you guys.
Thank Always
you.
A pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for being here. And we will see you next week.